from St. Louis Public Radio. This is the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jason Rosenbaum. Illinois Republicans in the Metro East appeared to vote for both change and the status quo on Tuesday. In Madison County, GOP voters dumped controversial board chairman Kurt Prenzler and emphatically chose Treasurer Chris Slusser to lead the fast-growing Metro East County. And Congressman Mike Bost held off a strong challenge from former GOP gubernatorial nominee Darren Bailey. Bost said during a speech in Murfreesboro that his win was an endorsement of his governing conservative philosophy.
I'm not going to do this forever. I'm not. But right now, I know what needs to be done. I've got the experience and the know-how to work with my colleagues to gain ground.
Joining us in studio is Will Bauer, St. Louis Public Radio's Metro East reporter, and Brian Munoz, STLPR's interim digital editor and a native of Southern Illinois. Will, Brian, welcome to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air.
Glad to be here.
Good to be here.
So, Will, we'll start with you. Slusser ended up beating incumbent county board chairman Kurt Prenzler by a landslide. My understanding is even Slusser was surprised by the margin. Why do you think he won so decisively?
Well, I think Prenzler had kind of been Teflon up until this point, right? He'd kind of been able to weather the storm of a lot of political controversy. But maybe this was just people saying, hey, you know, we want some change. And Chris Slusser was able to convince them of that.
So Prenzler has been described as, quote, embattled and, quote, controversial. I suppose any elected official can be tagged that way. But why was Prenzler such a divisive political figure within Madison County?
There's a number of different things. So going back to his first term, he was first elected in 2016, and right around in 2018 to 2019, the county had to lay off some employees that he had hired that were accused of hacking different county employees' emails. So that was the start of it. And in 2022, Prenzler had supported primary challengers to sitting county board members, which kind of ticked off the establishment GOP in the county. And then recently, there was an ethics violation that he was accused of, essentially. Right, it's a no-no to campaign on county time and on county property. He gave out a business card with his number on it, and it was a campaign business card. Now, whether or not it was nefarious from the start or a mistake, as he says, is, you know, something we'll never know. But that had, those are kind of just some of the issues that had been raised over the last 8 years.
So it's not out of the question that a Democrat could run in the general election, but I would say it's fair to assume Slusser will be favored no matter what in November?
That is correct. The Democrats have until June to slate a candidate if they would like. No Democrat ran in the primary. But yes, it would be a challenge for a Democrat to win in Madison County.
What sort of challenges and opportunities will Slusser have when he becomes board chairman? Covering county politics and government in St. Louis County for as long as I have, there definitely is a lot of drama, but there's also like governing and basic services that these people are going to need to do.
Yeah. And so actually both of these candidates, Prenzler and Slusser, would have told you their top issue is lowering property taxes because Illinois does have higher property taxes than a lot of states out there. So that is the number one issue. Maybe that's, you know, convincing local school districts and library districts to keep those tax levies as low as possible. And Slusser would also tell you there's a lot of room for economic development, specifically on the Mississippi River communities. And Slusser's from one of them in Wood River. So he'd say there's just lots of room to bring jobs into the community and boost economic development.
So turning to Brian Munoz here, you were in Murfreesboro, Illinois for Bost's victory party over former state senator Darren Bailey. What was the atmosphere like there?
Yeah, so it was held at Brews Brothers down there in Murfreesboro, a local brewery. And, you know, he was really surrounded by family and friends. And it was not a huge, you know, affair, but definitely an emphatic one in folks that seemed pretty confident that Mike was going to be able to take the victory.
I was pretty confident, too, that he was going to win because he had more money and he had the endorsement of Donald Trump, but he did not win by that much. Why do you think the race wasn't a blowout?
Right. I think the margin was only about 2,600 votes at the end of the day between the two candidates. And a big part of it had to do with this redistricting that happened recently there and a big addition of a portion of Mary Miller's district that's the Freedom Caucus member from the
15th district,
right?
Which, far eastern Illinois.
Yes.
Right. And she, you know, is a Darren Bailey supporter and had backed him. So it wasn't surprising to see that a lot of the folks from her district went to his side there.
But turnout wasn't it really, really low in this race? And was that surprising given that this was getting national attention? Because this was kind of seen as a proxy battle between like House Republican GOP leadership and like renegades like Matt Gaetz. And it seems like lots of people flocked to Southern Illinois for this contest. And by people, I mean prominent elected officials.
Right. And in talking to election judges from across the district, I mean, voter turnout was pretty abysmal. I think out of the roughly 584,000 voter age folks in Illinois 12, only about 16% came out to vote. And a lot of them say that just folks don't vote in primaries. Some folks, you know, don't want to declare a party. In Illinois, you have to declare a party to get that ticket, you know, and they didn't want to do that. But it seemed like if you were invested in this race, that those folks were out voting. But overall, it was still pretty bad.
When looking at the map, Boss just creamed Bailey in like the western part of the district that includes Metro East counties like St. Clair and Monroe. But he did pretty bad in the eastern part of the district. And some of those counties were in Darren Bailey's Senate district. Were either of you surprised by the geographical divide when it came to the results?
I would say no. I think, you know, at the end of the day, when you look at population, Mike Boss' old district, you know, has more people than what was picked up, you know, in the redistricting. And it made sense, you know, when you look at the map and you look at where each county went, you know, I didn't see any major surprises. I don't know. Will, what did you think on that?
And what Boss won was essentially his old county. And that's, like Brian said, it's got the population, and what Bailey would have won was his territory. So maybe it wasn't surprising, but it was a little surprising in that it wasn't close. What they won was landslide either direction.
Yeah. And one of the novel things about this race is I don't think Boston Bailey had wildly different political views, although Bost is probably a more pro-union Republican than many Republicans. He's a former union firefighter. He was opposed to right to work when former Governor Rauner tried to hoist it on the land of Lincoln. But this really just seemed to be about pragmatism versus dogmatism. Boss talking about being a governing conservative, Bailey talking about not being a sellout. Is this what we can expect in Illinois Republican primaries for the foreseeable future? Will, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I would imagine so, specifically because Bailey had said, tell me where your yard signs are. I'll come picking them up. I'll put them in storage. So reading between the lines, some people are saying, is he already thinking about challenging Bailey again in 2026? So I think we very well could see a very similar fight in 2 years from now.
Right. And I think, you know, it's that thing that you described exactly. You know, Darren Bailey came out saying, I'm not the status quo. I'm the fighter. You know, I'm the person that's not going to go with the quote unquote establishment. But Boss said, you know, this is what it takes to be able to get work done. You know, you have to be able to collaborate with other people. And he called for GOP unity, but that's going to probably be a challenge. I mean, even earlier today, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene filed a motion to oust House Speaker Mike Johnson after the House passed a $1.2 trillion spending bill. So we'll wait and see.
Brian Munoz is STLPR's interim digital editor, and Will Bauer is the Metro East reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. Brian, Will, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Jason.
Thanks.
Coming up, we'll talk about the latest Missouri polling results and what they could mean for the general election. This is the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. Welcome back to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jason Rosenbaum. Missouri is not the swing state it was during most of the 20th century. Republicans, for the most part, dominate statewide in legislative politics and will likely continue that electoral winning streak for the foreseeable future. But while the latest polling from St. Louis University and YouGov show that Missourians are more than amenable to Republicans for top statewide posts, they're willing to give left-of-center ballot initiatives a chance. Joining us in studio to discuss these results is Stephen Rogers, Associate Professor of Political Science at St. Louis University. Stephen, welcome.
Well, thank you, Jason. Thank you for having me.
And taking part in this conversation is Joe Manis, STLPR's Senior Political Correspondent. Joe, welcome to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air.
Thanks for having me. I'm very thrilled by this show.
Well, I am also thrilled to have you in studio for the first time on this show. So, Stephen, your poll showed that 52% of respondents would likely vote for a GOP candidate for Missouri governor compared to 38% for a Democratic candidate. What are some of the big takeaways from this finding?
No, so here what I would probably say, well, some of the big takeaways from this finding is that the Republicans are very likely to probably continue their control of the governor's mansion, say, following this election. And so here, so just listeners kind of know, what we did is we only asked, say, likely voters in Missouri. So we asked about 900 likely voters in February in terms of whether they intended to support the Democratic candidate for governor or the Republican candidate for governor. And Jason, as you said, what we found is about 52% of voters said they would support a generic Republican candidate, and then about 38% said they support a generic Democratic candidate. And so then following this, then what we then did is then we followed up with each of these voters in terms of, okay, so which of these Republican candidates that are kind of running for election in August and later, hopefully, in November, they're most likely to support. And then here, what we generally found is that when we looked at voters who said that they were going to support a Republican candidate in the general election, then these voters, basically about 28% said they'd support Jay Ashcroft, and like say they were most likely to support Jay Ashcroft, 10% said Mike Cahoe, and about 8% said Bill Eigel.
But 49% have also said they were unsure of their choice, and that makes it seems like it's possible the result could change if the election season heats up.
I absolutely agree here, Jason. And so one thing I do want to emphasize to listeners is that it's very important when you're looking at polling to kind of consider who you're sampling. And in here, what I want to emphasize when I'm saying these numbers is that we're looking at a general election likely voter like sample. And so this is not a primary election sample when I'm selling you these numbers. But Jason, I think your point is very well taken, in which when we're looking at the support for the Republican candidate and like which Republican candidate do you want to support, 49% said they were not sure. If we look at the same question on the Democratic side, it's 66% are not sure. And so here, a lot of voters may know that they're probably going to vote for a Republican or a Democrat, but they aren't quite sure about the candidates or who's running or necessarily have strong opinions about them.
So, Joe, the 52% gravitating toward a GOP candidate for governor, I mean, that's not particularly surprising to me because, as I've talked about ad nauseum, Democrats have done really poorly in rural and fast-growing suburban areas like Jefferson and Lincoln counties over the past few election cycles. How difficult do you think it's going to be for Democratic statewide candidates like for governor to piece that coalition together?
Well, a couple things. First, it's March. So nobody's running any ads, you know, major ads, unless you're really paying attention to what's going on locally.
Kehoe has those billboards, though.
Yeah, but that's, like, I know.
But the billboards don't vote, but continue,
right,
Joe.
And there aren't that many. But my point being is that actually the fact that the GOP in this general matchup has only a 14% spread, that actually, if I were a Democrat, I would be somewhat heartened, because I think it means that once the ads start running, a lot's going to depend on who's got money, who's got organization, what their message is, what issues that they're pushing resonate with people. And at March right now, we don't know any of that. So the fact that the Democrats only have they're only running 14% behind just the generic, actually isn't that bad. If it was like 20 or 25, I think then they'd be in a worse spot. And if you look on the breakdown, like, hardly anybody knows the Democrats or Republicans of the Democratic contenders right now. I mean, they got just a few percentage points. And I think Ashcroft's lead at this point, the Secretary of State for the governor, is probably likely name recognition.
Yes, because Jay Ashcroft is the son of John Ashcroft, who is a former Missouri governor, auditor, U.S. senator, and the former attorney general of the United States. So it's a pretty well-known name.
Yes, yeah. And so when somebody hears names, they probably don't even know who this Ashcroft is, other than he's been around a while. Although Jay has not been around a while compared to his dad.
But that gets to, we got a lot of listener questions today. Mm-hmm. And I think this undecided brings up this question from Dude Man Bro Guy on Reddit. The Reddit names are my favorite part about this show, as I've said many times. Is it harder to poll for mayor where there's a low turnout election with approval voting and difficult to reach neighbors on the north side? Are statewide down ballot primaries like secretary of state, treasurer, auditor, lieutenant governor, where there's mostly anonymous candidates? And I guess I would throw in governor, too, given that there are so many undecideds in this race. What do you think about this question about the difficulty of polling for statewide Missouri races?
No, so I think this is a very good question. And so kind of going to the Reddit user's question, polling in more local races can be very difficult. So here, like one thing that we can kind of talk about is that response rates to polls have like declined over time. People are not having landline phones as much. And so it's really hard to kind of sometimes reach more narrow geographic regions, such as like even St. Louis City or Kansas City itself. And so it is possible, but it's very expensive to kind of do. In terms of, the statewide kind of aspect of things, I think some of the comments that Joe brought up is right on point. A lot of people just don't know necessarily kind of what is going on necessarily yet in these races. And so here we are asking, the Democratic, Republican, generic on the statewide side. And I think that's somewhat informative of kind of what voters are going to do. But here I do think it's really important for people to kind of recognize that individuals don't necessarily know who is necessarily running for office. They may have an idea that Jay Ashcroft is running for governor, but I bet most voters, I don't have empirical data on this, don't know who's running the Secretary of State's race or who's dropping out of the Secretary of State's race this time. And so that does make it difficult. But partisanship itself is a really strong indicator of how people are going to vote. And so in that, they can give us at least some semblance of maybe what the state like that's going to happen in the upcoming election.
But sometimes you've got one issue. I'm going to go back to 2012, mm-hmm. which is arguably the last big Democratic statewide wave in this state. Mm-hmm. And most of the down ballot people who won, they won because Claire McCaskill, who was running for re-election for the U.S. Senate, mm-hmm. was hammering the Republican mm-hmm. nominee, Todd Akin, mm-hmm. over his abortion mm-hmm. comments, which had gotten national attention. And if you look, she won by so much, even though Romney mm-hmm. won the state. Mm-hmm. From her on down, everybody did. I mean, the Democrats won.
Yep.
Except for one. So my point being, sometimes there's something that comes out of nowhere. And going into like just a month before mm-hmm. The primary, all the numbers, all the assumptions were that McCaskill would probably lose because the Republican switch in the state was already becoming evident.
Yeah,
so what Joe just don't know.
Yeah, what Joe is talking about in 2012, Todd Akin was the nominee, and he went on Charles Jayko's show, and he said, if it's a legitimate rape, the body has the ability to shut the whole thing down.
Yeah,
and that pretty
yeah.
much ended his political career and gave Claire McCaskill another 6 years in office.
And it might not now, but back... But back then in 2012.
But let's stay on the topic of abortion, because the other illuminating finding in this poll, 44% of respondents said that they would support a ballot measure legalizing abortion compared to 38% opposed, 19% undecided. Stephen, this is not a majority, mm-hmm. and you need at this point 50% plus one. Mm-hmm. But do you think proponents of the Missourians for Constitutional Freedom Initiative have room to grow here?
No, so here you're exactly right in terms of like there's at least in our poll when we do this, we only find 44% kind of supporting. But here there's about a 7% margin of kind of people supporting to not supporting. And this is very consistent. So we did a similar question and right after the Dobbs decision in August 2022, where the margin of reversing the ban, we didn't have language there, in terms of was about 8%. But here, a really important thing to kind of consider is that there's 19% of voters who are not sure. And so then with this, what we did to explain to listeners a little bit is that we presented individuals responding to the poll the exact ballot language that is largely being collected, having signatures being collected for. And so in this is what voters will very likely see on the ballot itself, because what we wanted to do is we didn't want to kind of present our interpretation of the language itself. And so in here, when voters are kind of seeing this, there's five different bullet points, and this is the summary of the constitutional amendment. That's a lot for someone to absorb. But here, I bet the signatures are just still being collected. But then in it, there haven't been as many campaign ads about it. There hasn't been as much education about it. And so I really expect that if we pull on this again, say in 5 months, that 19% number will go down. I'm not going to necessarily make a prediction about like where it's going to go up from there. But I bet there's going to be more certainty later.
Do you know how many Republicans said respondents would support this initiative by any chance?
No, yeah. So here we had that 24% of Republicans said that they would support the initiative. And then Jason, in an earlier conversation that you and I had, we kind of talked about Biden and Trump voters. And so here, for example, if we go back and what we have in our poll is how did you vote in the 2020 election? And then similarly, 23% of Trump voters said that they were going to support the initiative. 72% of voters said that they were going to support Biden voters. Said they're going to support the initiative. And in here, just kind of provide some context of like support versus oppose. So for every one Trump supporter that is like supporting the initiative, there's only two people opposing it. Meanwhile, for every seven, say Biden voters who are supporting the initiative, there's only one like basically opposing it. So it's like a 7-to-1 ratio versus a 2-to-1 ratio. So there are a lot of Trump voters out there that are supporting this initiative.
Now, Joe, this kind of gets into this like trope we talk about all the time in Missouri politics about voters voting for Republican candidates and then left of center initiatives. I think there's a lot of reasons for that, including like opponents of these initiatives running terrible opposition campaigns. But you hear those numbers and it seems like this may not be as partisan of a choice for Missouri voters as people may think, given that abortion rights just is so highly segmented to the Republican and Democratic Party. Well, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, for one thing, it's a big issue for women. I've been saying this for 20 years, but especially since the Dobbs decision two years ago, it's a huge issue for women. And in most polls I've seen, a majority of women support abortion rights. But for decades, people on the other side, abortion opponents, long were the more passionate until the Dobbs decision. It's just been the last couple of years where things have really shifted because now, like in Missouri, it's virtually impossible to get an abortion. So one thing I noticed about this was that you had 44% of the independents. Now, granted, the sample size was smaller, so your margin of error is big. But only 44% of the independents were yes, compared to 71% of the Democrats, and whereas the 56% of the Republicans polled, it was no. So I think a lot's going to depend on, A, there has, like they've mentioned, there have been virtually no ads running now. I think right now the supporters are just focused on trying to get the signatures, and where opponents and some of their allies, like the frankly, the Catholic Church in the St. Louis area are trying to get people not to sign. So that's more of an underground campaign going on. But if they pass the signatures, I think then you'll see a ton of ads, and it'll be very different, and there won't be that many undecided.
Yeah, and just for our listeners, the proponents of this have until May to collect roughly 171,000 signatures. Although the total number is a little deceiving, they actually need a certain percentage of signatures in each congressional district. But I've been told that there are more volunteer signature gatherers compared to Right to Work in 2018. So we'll have to see how that ends up. We need to take a quick break, but when we return, we'll pick up our conversation about Missouri polling and voting behavior. This is the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. Welcome back to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jason Rosenbaum here with St. Louis University Stephen Rogers and STLPR Senior Political Correspondent Joe Manis. Now, before we get to a more general conversation about trust in polling, Stephen, another result from this poll that caught my attention was on sports betting. And it seems like there is wild support to bet on sports in Missouri. Can you talk about that?
No, yeah. So I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of your listeners, whether listening or having March Madness on in the background, and then here's a question of like whether or not it could be legal to be betting on sports in the state of Missouri. And so one of the questions that we did ask is like whether or not it should be legal in the state of Missouri for those who are 21 years or older to bet on different types of sports. And so in this, what we did is we asked separately for both professional sports and collegiate sports. And then what we found is that 60% of Missouri likely voters do believe that it should be legal for us to be able to bet on professional sports. And then we then found there's a little bit less support in terms of betting on collegiate sports, in which it's like only about 47% of people thought that betting on collegiate sports should be legal. Meanwhile, only 39% said it should be not legal. But still, this is still about an 8% margin, which is pretty healthy. And so what this is going to probably suggest is that if there's an initiative on the ballot later this year on sports betting, it probably will pass.
And before we get to the next part of our conversation, how much stock do you put in political polling? Has a poll result ever influenced your voting behavior? Have you ever participated in a poll? Email us at talk@stlpr.org or call us at 314-382-8255. That's 314-382-TALK. And in a first for the Politically Speaking Hour, we have a caller, Carrie from Chesterfield. You are on the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air.
Well, hi there. I was just calling and hoping that you guys could discuss the Republican attack on the citizen-initiated ballot measures.
Yes, and what the caller is talking about is efforts to raise the threshold to pass ballot initiatives in Missouri. Right now, it's a simple majority. There is a proposal on the table to make it by where you have to get a majority and a majority of congressional districts. It's not a sure thing that's going to make the ballot, and I think it's not a sure thing that it is going to pass. Carrie, is there anything that specifically interests you about that initiative?
Well, I just want people to be aware that they're trying to, thwart the democratic process by, trying to make it almost impossible for even initiatives to get put on the ballot.
Well, I think one thing we need to make clear is that if the General Assembly approves this measure to make it more difficult, it still would have to be approved by voters. And so one of the big discussions right now is whether, and the governor decides whether it goes on in August or November. And so there's a lot of talk behind the scenes is that if the General Assembly approves something, when would the governor put it on the ballot? And this ties into some of these proposed ballot measures, especially the one in abortion. Do they want to try to get it on the ballot before or at the same time? If it's at the same time, it wouldn't affect the abortion one. So this shows some of the strategy that's been going on behind the scenes. And people who are interested in this do need to be paying attention. I mean, Missouri is one of a block of states that do allow the state laws, state constitution, to be changed by the public.
So we are going to go back to the phones. John in Ferguson, welcome to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air.
Well, thank you. I have been called and given a poll, and the way that they asked the question kind of forced me into giving them a yes or no, even though I didn't feel that way about the subject. They had to do it like healthcare and one payer system. I can't really put down exactly how they asked it, but I was for one payer healthcare, but it forced me into saying no on that one subject. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and thank you for your call, John. Stephen, what about the way a poll question is asked? How important is that when it comes to making sure you get the most accurate results?
It's extraordinarily important, Jason. So the issue that the caller is raising is something very much to consider when you're interpreting any poll result. And so here, when you're trying to kind of evaluate pollsters, one thing that you want to look at is not just like whether or not basically is like, do you support this candidate or issue? Is that just kind of giving you like a little bullet point? Instead, you want to look at that full question wording, because here we can all kind of think of ways like I can phrase different things in different ways in order to lead people, in order to maybe be more supportive of an issue, or I can lead them to be opposed to an issue.
Do you have a specific example where somebody may be like pushed into a certain direction, which is, you know, I use that term purposely because those are typically called push pulls.
Exactly. Yeah. So the term that you're using is kind of like as a push pull itself. And here I'm just kind of thinking of one off the top of my head in which like you can maybe frame some. So even we can kind of think about the abortion issue in which is like we can maybe think, are we going to frame things in terms of, are we going to use the word abortion? Are we going to use the word term pro-life? Are we going to use the word term pro-choice? And so then in that, if I were basically to say, are you for or against this pro-choice amendment, I bet I would get a very different, not, or at least a little different response than if I said, what is the, like, do you support or oppose this anti-life amendment?
So yeah. Ken in South County emails, and this gets into our next part of our conversation, I don't believe that polling can be accurate in this era. People block unknown phone callers and do not open emails from unknown sources. Mm-hmm. This leads me to suspect that well-educated voters are less likely to respond to polls, thus skewing results. And that brings to mind that when I went to a Washington University conference in Cape Cod, Massachusetts in 2016, the professor was talking about how the gold standard of polls were over the phone. And now it seems like it has really shifted to where online polls are more accepted for a lot of reasons, including what Ken just mentioned. Mm-hmm. Stephen, can you talk a little bit about that? That evolution.
No, exactly. Yeah. So here there has been an evolution over time. And in here, like if we were doing a poll maybe 20 or 30 years ago, it'd almost probably be exclusively, well, if I go 30 years ago, almost exclusively landline kind of phone calls. And but here there's been a transition in which like we can actually look at how things have changed over time. People just actually don't have landline phones as much anymore. And so if we are going, like I believe it, the emailer's name was Ken, like the thing was, it's like, well, it's not representative anymore. But like if we kind of look at this statistics. Back in 2004, 90% of U.S. adults lived in a home with a landline. However, in 2022, that's numbers down to 29%. And so in here, if there's about 70% of U.S. adults that don't have this technology anymore in their house, and it's like, we want to get that representative sample. We want to get everybody. And so then in this, we need to diversify the way that we kind of outreach to, say, different voters or citizens in this country.
But cell phones are also problematic, mm-hmm. and I'm sure both of you had this issue. I've been getting like calls every day from people I don't know, mm-hmm. and I just will not answer it if it's a number I don't know. How does that affect the response rates if pollsters are primarily calling cell phones?
So here, pollsters are calling cell phones, but one thing also consider is that calling cell phones is actually more expensive than a landline because there's different laws and regulations about how what kind of auto-dialing features you can use. And so then here, I think a large takeaway is that it's important to kind of use a diverse set of ways to kind of reach respondents. And then additionally, as you have that diverse set, is to evaluate kind of like how well do these different, in, say, survey research, what we call them is modal effects, in which is like you may have one survey mode over phone, you may have another survey mode over, say, online. And so then here, there's organizations like the American Association for Public Research, Public Opinion Research, or the Pew Research Center, which are two organizations that these callers or listeners are really interested, have fantastic reports kind of outlining the differences between these modal effects.
Well, a couple things I like to mention is that, A, the intention of polling isn't always to gauge how many people are for and against. One of the reasons they use this push wording mm-hmm. is because maybe the intention of the pollster mm-hmm. isn't to get you to vote a certain way, but they want to have numbers a certain way so they can appeal to their donors mm-hmm. and potential supporters. Mm-hmm. So when if you are participating in a poll, you have to keep that in the back of your mind. Mm-hmm. The gentleman who talked to us a few minutes ago, that may very well have been a group that was trying to get a particular result to show their supporters or their donors, so they're trying to push him to respond a certain way. That's one thing.
No.
And two, if you look at the results at the ballot box, let's say in the last year and a half, a lot of it has not reflected whatever the polls had been right before then, which shows that it's still difficult to poll the exact demographics of who's turning out.
I mean, I'll give you an example of this because we had a listener McCarthy on Threads say, it seems that polls underestimate the Republican vote in deep red states like Missouri and the Democratic vote in deep blue states. Any guess why? And that comes to mind in 2020. Polls were showing a relatively close race between Governor Parson and State Auditor Nicole Galloway. It wasn't close at all. It was a 17-point landslide. And there are other examples, too, where Missouri polls showed close races in 2016 for governor. You know, there was a point where Todd Akin was in the lead before his meltdown. Is there, this may be more of a question for Stephen, but is Missouri just a difficult place to poll for some reason? And if so, why?
No, so this is a very good question in which, like, well, first I want to echo Joe's point in terms of, like, these polls necessarily, not necessarily they're being push polls. But additionally, another thing to kind of consider, and it's right in line with what Joe said, is, like, sometimes not all these pollsters release all the poll findings that they have. So if they have a favorable finding, they may release it, and other times they may not. And so when listeners are kind of thinking about this, it's another thing to consider. But returning, Jason, to your question of is Missouri a difficult state to poll, there are some challenges that Missouri does have. And so then here, for example, we have fewer pollsters, like we aren't a very competitive state. And so then in this, we don't have as much, say, competition in the polling industry, or additionally in terms of, like, there's not a lot of high, like, people aren't investing as much into the polling industry. And then additionally, something that's also going to be kind of speaking to earlier is that Missouri does have, say, some urban areas and some more rural areas. And then one thing, in as we transition to different modes of, like, say, polling, there may be more, say, people with broadband access in the city, in the urban areas, and more less broadband access in the rural areas.
Yeah, and that was to get to my question about if there are any concerns about online polls, about who's filling them out, how they're contacted. Like, I still think that there's still maybe some hesitancy about the medium.
Mm-hmm. So there's always going to be hesitancy about the medium, because here I will concede, yes, St. Louis University and UGov were doing, like, an online poll. And so then in this is one kind of form of of medium. But there were actually even concerns when we switched to phone polling. So polling prior to phones was done door to door. And so there's, like, who are you actually going to reach? And then additionally, when you did phone polling a little bit more traditionally in the, say, 1960s and 70s, there was a concern, who picks up the phone? And so a lot of times there may have been, like, social norms that one person, particularly maybe the woman in the household, picked up the phone. And so no matter what, we're always going to have these challenges, kind of like with the polling and, like, trying to assess public opinion. But one thing I would suggest is, like, when listeners are trying to interpret polls or look at polls, just look at, like, hopefully the pollster is going to be transparent. So we're going to kind of say what we are doing, show what our sample is, and then kind of present in an objective manner kind of what we have.
In the last minute we have left, that gets to, like, the key question. There's been a lot of distrust of polls nationally after 2016, even after 2022. The red wave didn't materialize.
Mm-hmm.
I'll ask this to both of you. What do you think pollsters should do to engender trust with the public? Stephen, you go first, then Joe.
So one of my main recommendations that pollsters should do is, again, kind of a theme I touched on earlier, is be transparent. And so here in which, like, basically, because we do, sometimes a pollster can just release a result and we don't know. So an earlier caller brought up, what is the question wording? Also, what kind of questions have raised on the show? What is the sample? And so maybe little cues that individuals can do in order to kind of look at whether a poll is transparent is that, are they reporting the methodology?
A good sample would be what, 900, 1,000, 1,100?
So here, the more voters that you have in the sample, it would be, like, a stronger, probably you're going to have less uncertainty. But this, what I would kind of caution is that there are different, like, there's not a perfect translation, but generally you can probably do a solid poll of 900 to 1,500 people.
Joe.
Well, and the other thing is, what are the demographics of the poll versus who ends up turning out at the voting
booths?
And so if they undersample women, undersample rural voters, whatever, it's going to, the poll may not reflect the electorate.
Absolutely, Joe.
Joe Manis is STLPR senior political reporter, and Stephen Rogers is an associate professor of political science at St. Louis University. Stephen, Joe, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jason.
The Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air is produced by Jason Rosenbaum, Alex Hoyer, Emily Woodbury, Danny Wisentowski, Maya Norfleet, and Elaine Cha. Audio engineering and sound design by Aaron Dorr. The politics editor is Fred Ehrlich, and our production intern is Roche Hemmings.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. understanding starts here.
St. Louis on the Air proudly supports local artists by using music from Life Creative Group.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.